that people would complain when what is required, if you will, to go to heaven is something easier than falling off a log. you not only don't do something for it, you have to cease trying to do something for it. So you not only don't work to get saved, you have to not work. You have to not try to earn it. You have to accept it as a gift and acknowledge that God is the gift giver, if you will.
Hey guys, and welcome to the Defending Christianity podcast. You can probably guess what we'll be doing, defending Christianity. While looking at different arguments that try to disprove Christianity, our goal is to look at the evidence that supports the claim of Christianity that our argument is targeting. Join me as we discuss from a skeptical perspective how Jesus is who he says he is, and how God includes you in his redemptive plan for humanity. I'm your host, Levi Dade, and this is the Defending Christianity podcast. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome back to Defending Christianity Podcast. I'm your host, Levi Dade, and we're going to be discussing something really great today. Today we're going to be covering on if Jesus is actually necessary for heavenly citizenship or to get into heaven. You know, so have you ever had someone tell you that you only need to be a good person to go to heaven? Has someone ever told you that Jesus isn't necessary to go to heaven? But what about all the good someone does? Won't that be enough? And today those are the things that we're going to tackle. I think it's something that needs to be heard because it's understandable why someone would think doing good gets you into heaven. Because our earthly standard is when you do good, you get rewarded. And heavenly reward, to a lot of people, sounds like it would be fair to say that that comes by the means of being a good person. Another thing that is thought that God is a loving God, and because he's a loving God, he would never send someone to hell. Or at least he wouldn't send anyone to hell who do good on earth. So who do we have with us today to discuss this? We have Dr. Richard Howe. Dr. Richard Howe and I sat down and we had a very great discussion about this. The interview actually went longer than we had planned, which is why this is going to be a two-part series. So because of that, today you won't hear the entire interview, but our next episode will finish it out. And I believe it's amazing. I think Dr. Howe did a great job at answering these questions in a convicting way and in a way that might help us understand not only how to have these conversations with others and answer these questions, but also whether or not Jesus is actually necessary for heaven and why. So I really encourage you to come back for part two on that and just hear the second half of the interview, which in my opinion is where we really get into some deep, heavy stuff. And Dr. Howe is a professor of philosophy and apologetics at Southern Evangelical Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina. Dr. Howe has a BA in Bible from Mississippi College and a master's in philosophy from the University of Mississippi and a PhD in philosophy from the University of Arkansas. So as you will hear in the interview, Dr. Howe is from Mississippi and went to college where some of my friends from high school go today. Shout out to Levi Manos. But as we listen in on the interview, I just encourage you to kind of be thinking in the back of your mind, how can I use what I'm hearing to maybe answer somebody's questions who don't have a high regard for Jesus being the only way to heaven? And if that's you, then maybe this might be something that might can also get you thinking about the possibility that it might take something more. But all that to say, let's just get into the interview and see what God has to say to us today. And remember, if you have any questions, feel free to email me at defendingchristianitypodcast@gmail.com. I'd be happy to answer some questions. And like I said in the past, I don't know everything, but if there's something I don't know, we can just look at it together and figure it out together. If it's something that I do know, I'd be happy to help you. So join me now as we get into the interview. Enjoy, guys.
Greetings.
Hey, how are you doing?
Hi, man.
So you had a deadline this past week. Well, what was that for? Was that for
New York? So I was writing two articles for an upcoming it's called Harvest Handbook on Faith and Science, or Science and Faith, one of them. So it's a follow-up. Some time ago, a few years ago, they did the Harvest Handbook on Apologetics. I did about seven articles in here. So they asked me to do two for the upcoming. So I tease people because when I have these writing deadlines, I feel like I'm back in school. You know that feeling of dread you have when you've got a paper due, right?
Absolutely.
Exactly. The same feeling when you get.
I thought about that.
In writing.
Mm-hmm. Whenever I'm talking to somebody or I'm emailing with somebody who's
who's well regarded in their field, and they're like, well, I have this deadline for this. And I'm like, huh, I wonder if they feel like I feel whenever I have an essay exactly. due or like an exegetical paper due or something.
Yeah, it looms all largely in your mind, and you're kind of like, man, I can't sleep. I got to get up and work or whatever.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
It's funny. Yeah.
For sure. So where are you at now? You're from Mississippi.
I'm in Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay.
Yeah, I live in the Atlanta area, so I'm way up north. In fact, it looks like we're about to have a pretty strong thunderstorm. So if you hear a lot of thunder in the background, that's what that.
That's okay.
But I tell people we live about as far north of Atlanta as you can be and still be the Atlanta area.
Mm. So you're like right on the line of it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm way up north. We're close to between 40 and 50 miles from downtown Atlanta, but it's still the metropolitan area.
Well, if it's okay with you, I'm just going to jump on in.
Absolutely.
So just talk a little bit about your background. How did you get into apologetics and philosophy?
Well, I like to tell this story because in some respects, I'm not typical. I mean, having been born and reared in Mississippi, born in Jackson, pretty much grew up most of my life in Tupelo, Mississippi. And as you are aware, maybe a lot of people are aware, that sort of area from, say, Texas up to North Carolina, perhaps, is considered the Bible Belt, meaning it has a disproportionate concentration of Bible-believing or evangelical Christians. But what's odd is having been born and reared there, I wasn't raised in the church. So even though I had a great family, my parents were hardworking, loving, I had four brothers, and it was, you know, middle class, stable, everything great, but I never heard anything about the gospel. It just, church wasn't. Now, I was number four in the series of five children. So maybe some of my older brothers, perhaps they went to church. My parents might have taken them. I'll have to ask them that. But I know by the time I came around, we were a pretty secular family. But I never can remember a time that I didn't believe in the existence of God. So I'm a counterexample to those people that come along and say, well, you know, the reason you're a Christian is you're born in a Christian culture, whatever, a Christian home. If you had been born in India, you'd likely be Hindu. I go, well, I was born in this Christian, but I wasn't a Christian because of that, because I didn't get any kind of reinforcement. So the short version is, the Lord really began to deal with me when I was about 14 years old. I didn't understand what was happening, but I really started developing this concern and yearning about what God's claim on my life was, at least as much as you can do that at that age, at 14. And between 14 and 16, I started going to church. I'd get my mom to take me to church before I was driving. And through the influence of friends of mine in high school, when I was 16 years old, as a sophomore in high school, I trusted Christ. I actually did it at school. We used to have these campus life meetings every Tuesday night at Tupelo High School. And it was through one of the speakers there that I heard and understood the gospel. All right, so you figure, okay, well, great. Now you're in everything. That's where the story ends. Actually, that's sort of where it begins in this respect. I'm growing about as much as you could think a 16, 17, 18-year-old kid would grow. Went off to, well, what they call now community colleges. Back then, they were called junior colleges. So we had junior colleges all over the U.S., a two-year entry, sort of you get your core stuff out of the way before you go to a university. So I was on that track, and I was a music major. I'm a old rock and roll drummer from the 70s. I didn't play with anybody, but I played at church and in various rock bands around the neighborhood or something like that. So I went off to college, studied music. Didn't take me long to decide I didn't want to be a professional musician. I'm not sure I had the talent or much less the personality. And then somebody told me that you could go off to school and study the Bible, to college. And I'd never heard of such a thing. I thought, that's the most amazing thing I've ever. I said, that's what I want to do. So I went to Mississippi College. This would have been now in the middle 70s. What I was not prepared for, because my church hadn't prepared it for me, was Mississippi College, first of all, was just a wonderful Christian environment. It was a great place to flourish as a Christian student, except the religion department. Anybody familiar with the Southern Baptist Convention in the 70s will realize that the convention was in the throes of a lot of controversy surrounding inerrancy of the Bible, and I was a casualty of that. And largely because I wasn't prepared for the questions that were coming and the sort of subtle skepticism about the integrity of the Bible that I encountered in my classes and from my classmates. So I lost my faith in college, in effect. Now, I don't believe you can lose your eternal life, but, you know, you can lose a lot of other stuff, including your confidence. So here I am, 19 years old and into 20 years old and just not being sure what I believed about Christianity anymore. I never came to a point where I doubted God's existence, but I know that I remember being just really not sure what I thought about Jesus anymore. So what happened was then God began to bring various apologists into my life through their ministries. People like Norman Geisler, R.C. Sproul, or Josh McDowell, even Cornelius Van Til. And that began to bring me back to affirm what I had believed before in terms of the inerrancy of the scriptures and this solid evangelical theology. But I was beginning to learn now why I believed what I believed. That was the key in my life. And then the last part of the segment to explain, well, why am I doing what I'm doing today? When I went to seminary, Dallas Theological Seminary, and I became a student of Norm Geisler, I was sort of disappointed in seminary because the itch I needed scratching was apologetics. That's what I became very interested in because of the role it played in my life as somebody already a believer, of reinforcing what you already believe and giving you stronger confidence. But there weren't really choices back then to study apologetics in seminaries. It just didn't exist in the 80s. In fact, a lot of seminaries are getting rid of their apologetics. So Norm Geisler gave me some of the best advice I ever had in my educational track. He encouraged me to go back to the university and study philosophy because he knew what I learned later, that while philosophy is not everything in apologetics, it is an important segment of apologetics and, for that matter, theology. So that's what I did. I went back, moved back to Mississippi, went to Ole Miss, did a master's in philosophy there, and then was at Marquette University in their doctoral program for a while before I finally ended up at University of Arkansas in Fayetteville to finish my PhD in philosophy. So now that's what I went on to do, is teach philosophy and apologetics. And I started at Southern Evangelical Seminary in 1995 and have been there either part or full time ever since, for the most part. So that's why. And that's what I'm doing now. I'm teaching there. Officially, I'm an adjunct faculty, but I have a full time load. And everything's done through Zoom, so I don't have to move away from my Atlanta area where my wife Rebecca and I live. So
that's awesome. That's
maybe
really
more than you wanted to know about it, but that explains why.
That's a great testimony, and it actually reinforces the whole premise of why I'm even doing Defending Christianity. I noticed that nobody knows why we believe what we believe in the Bible Belt region.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I always wondered, I was like, why hasn't my church taught me this? Why didn't I ask these questions? I guess it's just like you said, that herd mentality. You've heard about this since you were literally born, and so you don't question it. It's as much of a fact as
a lot of people were.
Yeah, and so I was like, I really want to do something that kind of can give people that information that they need, so when they are approached by a skeptic, they can have something.
That is so important. That is so important because I think what happens, as happened to me, is if the first times a person hears a challenge to their faith or to the integrity of the Bible, if the first time they hear that is long after they've left home and they're in college, it makes you wonder, well, why didn't my church tell me that that verse isn't in the oldest manuscripts of the Bible or this book is not written not too long after the Bible, but it's not in the Bible. So why is it, those kind of questions. If the first time you hear about them is from some skeptical professor, it makes you feel like, well, they were trying to hide this from me, maybe.
Yeah, why don't you hear about like the Apocryphon?
Yeah, no. So I appreciate Defending Christianity ministries like this, doing what you do to help educate, especially high school and college bound and then college students and young adults of these questions and answers.
Mm. I've noticed it does two things, really, when you're approached by a skeptic and you don't know the answers because you haven't been taught. It does two things. It either makes you doubt and then that becomes another atheist, or it doesn't bring somebody who is a skeptic to a saving knowledge of Christ. And so
absolutely. It's a lose-lose
either way.
You miss a good opportunity. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You miss an opportunity, don't you? If you didn't have the answer right then, and of course you can't know everything and you're always bound to be asked something you don't know the answer. But at least a better answer than I don't know might be, that is a good question. Let me see if I can find out the answer and get back to you. That's how Norm Geisler became the apologist that he is every time he got asked something, he said, you know what, let me see what I can find out and I'll get back. And he started awesome. Learning all this stuff about the integrity of the Bible and the history of Christianity and the, you know, the philosophical case, all these kind of things, and became the apologist that he was.
Absolutely. I've actually had a couple of friends since this kind of tell me, I kind of want to get into knowing some more about this stuff. I said, a good place to start is a documentary called The God Who Speaks. That's the DVD. Yeah, you got the DVD.
I grabbed it off the shelf knowing
that we were going to
maybe bring it up.
Now, I know that you did play a role in the production of it. And could you give us a little bit of information about that and about what The God Who Speaks is all about?
Yes, absolutely. So the ministry that funded it for the most part is the American Family Association, which is in Tupelo, Mississippi. So I've known these guys that run that ministry and are part of that ministry since some of them were little bitty kids and are now grown up and are a part of the ministry. And they went to my church, and so I knew a lot of them. And I've written for American Family Association before. I've written a monograph on homosexuality in America. I've written some Bible high school curriculum and things. So I've had a working as well as a ministry and friendship relationship with the ministry for decades. So M.D. Perkins, whose parents were good friends of mine, we all went to the same church. M.D. is now kind of heads up the American Family Productions or Films or something. I'm embarrassed. I don't get the exact, but it's basically the a media wing of the ministry that does documentary films and curricula and things like that. So he had this idea some years ago. He wanted to, he's done a lot of documentaries and he's still doing them. They just keep churning them out every few years. Amazing stuff. And he had this idea of a documentary that would give the case for the integrity of the Bible. Mm-hmm. But he also was wise enough to know that there are a lot of minefields in that subject. That is to say, there are a lot of issues that are controversial and are important, but some of these issues are not, you don't have to necessarily deal with all of them in one documentary. You know, you got to get started, right? You got to make the case before you can start getting in the weeds. So what he wanted was some guidance as to really two things, how to sort of navigate that minefield. What is worth bringing up? What is a hill worth dying on? And then what is a controversial issue that, while important, isn't important enough to detract from the main point?
Yeah.
It's sort of maybe something a little bit deeper in the weeds, as I said. So he being the friends that we were, and he knew I was a seminary professor, he asked me if I would be willing to come on board and be an ongoing consultant where we would just brainstorm. That was one thing. The other was helping him with connections, getting some people to be in the documentary, because some of those in there were personal friends of mine. And while he had the tools to approach them professionally, a lot of times these kinds of connections are better if it's done through a personal connection. So I was able to kind of run interference, not because the participants were reluctant. It's just that you can imagine if you're approached and say, hey, would you sit down for an interview and be in a documentary? You can imagine what some people might think if they don't know who these people are putting this on. And you don't really have time to do all the research to figure out. So you don't know who to trust, right? So I kind of ran interference with some of them going, no, I'm telling you, you know me, I know them. They're 100% the real thing. And they're like, that's good enough for me kind of stuff. So that was fun. So MD and I spent hours on the telephone talking about various issues and who would be good for this subject and what would be a good angle on that, just whatever kind of brainstorm. And perhaps he used some of my ideas. I know he used some of the connections that I made, because I got some of the speakers who were initially reluctant for whatever reason to come on board. So that was fun to be a part of that and then see my name in the crawl. I felt like I had become somebody at the end, in the credits at the end. Look, Ma, there I am.
Hey, that's how I felt just to see Tupelo, Mississippi in the credits.
Oh, exactly.
I'm from there.
That's perfect. Exactly. Same way, man. Homeboy pride.
So to get in our topic today, our target argument that we're going to be discussing is that you can be a good person outside of Christ and still get into heaven. And so just to start, you know, people would suggest today that God is the God of the Bible is a God of love. And we would agree with that pretty strongly. Mm-hmm. But some people take that a step further and say that since he's a God of love, he would not send people to hell. And therefore they think that being good enough will save them because God's love has him, because he's too loving to do that. How would you respond to somebody who says this or who believes that?
So I can understand why people would ask this, because I think those of us who are convinced that the Bible is absolutely true probably still are uncomfortable with the concept of hell and just trying to fathom the concept of eternal torment that's irreparable and unchanging. And so no one should just feel comfortable and celebrate. You know, the Lord says, I take no delight in the death of the wicked. So it's not something to be celebrated. But having said that, I acknowledge that there is a very important sense in which people are or can be, quote, good. I mean, we obviously make a distinction between an Adolf Hitler, let's say, and then a Mother Teresa, or pick somebody, some philanthropist that you admire, a really nice person. There's obviously a difference there. So whatever else we say about God and his relationship to us and heaven and hell, we don't want to negate that. Otherwise, we just lose our credibility as Christians if we just make it sound like, well, the difference between Hitler and Mother Teresa is non-existent or trivial. People, I think a lost person just go, okay, that doesn't seem right. There seems to be just abject evil in the world. But at the same time, what I think those same people fail to understand is exactly what we mean and what the Bible means and what even God has revealed through nature means about God being holy, infinitely holy. So there, in terms of sort of ratio, the difference between a Hitler and a Mother Teresa is minimal compared to the difference between all of us and God. That is, it's an infinite span of absolute infinite holiness. So our position as Christians is that you have to be absolutely perfect and holy to be in God's presence. Anything short of that is then relegated to this eternal repository of evil called hell. All right. But I think a lot of people fail to appreciate the fact of what the gospel is actually offering. That is to say, this perfection, this absolute perfection that is required to be in heaven is offered as a free gift. It's not something that people have to do to work at it. Maybe we can get more into that as we go along. But in other words, we're not saying you've got to 100% toe the line or God's going to throw you into hell. And then everybody rightfully would just go, well, that just seems impossible. And we go, yeah, it is impossible. That's why what you need to get into heaven is offered to you freely as a gift. So it's very interesting, Levi, in scripture, how often the scriptures talk about people doing things that seem good to them. The references like, well, even in Genesis 3, when Eve saw the fruit was pleasant, was desirable, and was good for food when she was looking at the tree. To her, this looked like a good. To God, though, it was an evil in as much as it was in violation of his dictates and commands. And so you see things in Judges and even in the narratives of Kings, even in Proverbs, where people did that which was right in their own eyes. And it's conspicuously contrasted with something like I got before me here, 1 Kings 15:5. It says, because David did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. And that jumped out at me. Go, okay, well, there's a difference between me doing what is right in my own eyes and doing what is right in God's eyes. It's that latter that matters as far as this question of heaven and hell. So hell, I guess one last thought on that. You know, C.S. Lewis picks up on this metaphor that the doors to hell are locked from the inside. I mean, I think it's fair to say God doesn't send people there. He gives them the opportunity to avoid hell by trusting in Christ. But if people choose not to do that, then they are in effect sending themselves to hell by their own sin and their own refusal to accept the free gift. If you've got cancer and someone says, look, I've got this pill and it'll cure your cancer, and you just go, you know what? It looks like a kind of big pill. I'm not so sure. I feel like I'm not really that hungry. I don't really want to swallow a pill, or whatever the reason. If they don't take the pill, they can't turn right around and go, well, why did you kill me with cancer? So I didn't kill you. Cancer killed you, and I didn't give you your cancer. You got it yourself for smoking, whatever. You can make up any kind of hypothetical. The point was, you didn't take the remedy. It was given to you for free. All you had to do is take it. You didn't do it. your blood is on your own hand.
Yeah. So by trying to do good things to earn your way into heaven, you're kind of selling yourself out of what it actually takes to get into heaven, which that thing is actually free. And
absolutely. So it's just, one of my favorite verses in this regard is Romans 4, verses 4 and 5. They say, to him who works, his wages are not counted as a gift, but as a debt. In other words, if you work for your salary, your boss isn't giving you a gift by paying you your paycheck, right? He owes you that paycheck because you earned it. But then the verse goes on, but to him who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is counted as righteousness.
Oh, man, that's
great,
powerful
encapsulation of the gospel. One of the things that sort of scandalizes us slightly in the English is in English, the verb believe and then the noun faith actually come from two different etymologies. I think believe comes through the German and then faith as it comes through the Latin. So in English, they sound like two completely different words, right? But in Greek, the noun faith and the verb believe are the same word. One is just the noun form of the word and one's the verb form. The noun is pistis, P-I-S-T-I-S, and the verb is pistuo, I believe. So to have faith is the same as to believe. Mm. That's what that verse, to him who does not believe, but does not work, but believes on him who justifies the ungodly, his faith, well, in effect, it's like his belief is counted as righteousness. That's what
you could say to him who has faith.
Yeah. Absolutely. You could do it the other way. Say, to him who does not work, but has faith, his faith is counted as righteous. That may even be a better way to do it.
Maybe. So when people claim that they can be good enough to go into heaven, it seems to me that they decide what the standard of good is and what the standard to have that heavenly citizenship is.
Absolutely.
So who decides the standard once and for all, and how do we know?
You know, in Matthew 7, a verse that's often brought up, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name and in your name done many wonderful works and all these wonderful things? And then Jesus says, but I never knew you. And I often hear people quote that verse as if somehow, you better take an inventory of what kind of life you're living as far as whether you're meriting your stance before God, kind of, you know, whether you're earning your way. Because realize a lot of people, they work really, really hard and they still don't make it. Jesus said, I never knew you, blah, blah, blah. What's interesting, when in Matthew 7, Jesus says basically that they did not do the will of the Father. In John 6, Jesus was approached specifically and asked, what must we do the will of God? And Jesus' answer was very telling and direct. He said, this is the will of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent. So why is it believe? Why is it that we have to believe in Jesus? Because, as we've already said, what it takes to be in heaven is something unachievable by our own efforts. So it has to be given to us as a gift. Well, you can only receive a gift. You can't earn a gift, or it wouldn't be a gift. It'd be pay. So that's what's going on. And this standard, then, is the standard of infinite righteousness and holiness to be with God. No unclean thing will be in his presence. And if you think about it, those of us who will be in heaven should be glad, not that there are people in hell, but should be glad that there's not anything in heaven that is corrupting and evil, that we've been liberated from that and it's been eradicated from our presence. We ought to be glad about that, that that standard is held so highly of God's own infinite righteousness, so that we can get in free by a gift. And once we're there, nothing else is there that isn't completely pure, and we're insulated.
Yeah. And so since God holds the standard for what it takes, he also holds the means of it. He holds, I guess you can say, how you are to achieve that standard. And if it's through Jesus, that's the only way. And so
that's
there's
right.
No other way around that. And so,
and you think about it, it's odd that people would complain when what is required, if you will, to go to heaven is something easier than falling off a log. you not only don't do something for it, you have to cease trying to do something for it. So you not only don't work to get saved. You have to not work. You have to not try to earn it. You have to accept it as a gift and acknowledge that God is the gift giver, if you will.
Absolutely. Going off of that, do you think people who do try to earn salvation, do you think that they don't even know what salvation is if that's what they're doing?
I think there is a sense in which yes, because it's like they're not yet coming to terms with the fact that they're the creature and God is the creator. That relationship, that any kind of relationship that there could be between the creature and its maker has to be at the behest of the maker, in a sense. Mm-hmm. He has to dial us up, so to speak. We're not going to be able to reach out to him. You know, the word religion, it's not real positive where the word came from, but one theory is that it has to do with sort of a reconnection, that we sort of re-tie in to what's ultimate. You go, well, if that's what religion is, sort of Christianity is like the exact opposite, because all the world's religions that I'm familiar with that even have a notion of a deity, it's basically what people have to do to reach God. But the Christian message is, no, this is what God did to reach us, not what we do to reach him. What we do, and C.S. Lewis has great metaphors. There are certain paradoxes in life. For example, if you are drowning, you get caught in a rip current or whatever, and you're drowning, and a lifeguard comes to your aid, the way to ensure that you are going to drown is if you try to struggle to not drown. The only way a lifeguard can rescue you is if you stop trying to not drown and just give up. And then only then can the lifeguard safely keep you from drowning and keeping himself from drowning, right?
Yeah.
You don't try to earn relationship with God and eternal life. You let it be given to you. So I think people don't realize what's at stake in terms of a eternal relationship with an infinite creator God who is infinitely holy. And if they think salvation is just, you know, more or less being a good person, making the world a better place than when you left it, you just want to go, you know what, the stakes are infinitely greater than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think something that a lot of people may miss is that when you think that it takes somebody doing almost basically the standard of perfect and they try to achieve that, it creates pride in them. And that's by default taking you away from that standard of perfect, because pride is sinful. And I think either way you go with that.
That is a very important insight, I think, that it's humiliating to some people to think that I can't do it myself and I need somebody else to pull me out. You know, that in some respects, that's almost anti-American, isn't it? Where this rugged individualism, I'm going to make it, I'm going to pull myself up by my own bootstraps and make it in this world. I don't want any charity, blah, blah, blah. And it's an affront to our pride. So I think that's a great insight that you just brought up, is that it assaults our pride and we don't want to humble ourselves and be humbled before our maker. But after all, you think about it, we're creatures. You know, we didn't make ourselves. We don't sustain ourselves in existence. We're being given our existence by God's grace. It's far from humiliating to submit yourself to an infinite being.
Absolutely.
Okay, everybody, that concludes part one of Is Jesus Actually Necessary for Our Heavenly Citizenship? And you know, Dr. Howell said a lot of good things about what it takes to actually go to heaven. And he was able to really help, at least in my opinion, he was really good about getting us to understand through scripture, but just through logic as well, why Jesus is necessary for salvation and why us trying to do it on our own will not sustain it. In part two, we're going to go deeper and ask more questions about it. And I really hope that everybody comes back and listens in on that as well, because this was not the end of the discussion, but it was really just the halfway point. And so the rest of the interview has to do with how we as followers of Jesus can have those conversations and answer those questions about whenever we're having a conversation with somebody and somebody says, well, all I need to do is go to heaven. To go to heaven is to just be a good person. part two, we spend a great deal of time talking about how we can answer that type of argument and those questions that pertain to it. So it's for Christians, but then we go back into why it is true and how we know it as well. And so for everybody out there who's listening, I just really encourage you all to come back for part two of that, because it's going to be really good, and it's going to help us just anchor our faith deeper, because it's going to give us reasons for our faith and how we know that it's true. So please come back and join us for part two of our discussion on if Jesus is necessary to go to heaven. God is moving in the world, and he can use you to be a part of that. But it only comes whenever we decide to actually let him do that. So go out there, have faith, believe, and please stop working for your salvation, because all it takes is to believe in the one who he sent, Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Levi Dade, and I can't wait for part two. See you guys next time.